Hello, and welcome to another episode of I Never Thought It Would Happen. It's made in collaboration with the wonderful charity that is Simply Help Musicians. I'm joined in this episode of I Never Thought It Would Happen by a fine singer-songwriter who's certainly put in the time and the graft to reach very heady heights. Like me, he's found an outlet through poetry that has really set him up for his journey. He's worked with such greats as Kylie Minogue and Nile Rodgers, among many others. Please welcome the utterly charming Jack Savarotti. Hey Jack, welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, which is a podcast for help musicians. Do you know anything about them at all?
No, could you fill me in? Could you give me more?
Yeah, they started over 100 years ago by Edward Elgar and Vaughan Williams to raise funds for a chum of theirs who had died, but their family didn't have enough money to bury him, which is kind of weird. So over the years, the charity has grown, and during the pandemic, they gave out £20 million to musicians who were on their arse around the country, which was an amazing thing. They also, you know, have a hotline for people with depression. It's just an incredible charity, really. Have you ever heard of anything like it?
No, I haven't. I mean, I've heard of different sort of attempts on smaller levels, like you said, like for the individual musician. I've sort of heard of people, but I've never heard that this was this. I didn't know about this kind of union behind it. I love that. And Elgar started it, you say?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
That's amazing. Yeah. That's phenomenal.
I mean, I was speaking to a young student the other day who had was really in a bad time, and she managed to get £3,000 to record her first EP from the charity. So it really, really works.
That's so cool. How does one apply for it?
You don't need to worry about that, Jack.
No, but I'm curious. I'm curious because I've actually been sort of, I've been wanting to set up something similar to that. Not so much for musicians, but from where I live. I had an experience last year of working with an amazing young girl who didn't have enough money for treatment for a very particular form of cancer around here. And I live in Oxfordshire. Mm-hmm. And she was from a very well-to-do, middle-class sort of family. But the treatment was so expensive, and it was such a rare form of cancer that she needed to go to America and needed all this money. And it just kind of threw me that somebody in this position couldn't have the funding for that. You know, it was a real matter of life or death, depending on the funding. So I've been curious to know how to set something like this up myself on different terms.
Well, with the help musicians, you go online and you fill out a form, and that gets reviewed by the team, and they get in contact with you, and they have a Zoom conference with you and see how you are and what it is that you need, really.
That's so cool.
And during the lockdown period, I was lucky enough to work with various songwriters for a whole year online, and that's how I got involved with them.
Oh, brilliant.
So, Jack, when did you first pick up the pencil to write? What was your first inspiring time for you?
It was actually when I was about 15. I was academically rubbish, to say the least. I've always been interested in stuff. Yeah. But I can definitely say that in the academic environment, I really shut out what I should have been paying attention to. I was more curious at sort of analyzing everybody in the room than listening to the teacher, or analyzing the teacher himself or herself rather than what she was actually or he was saying. Mm-hmm. So it was only when poetry came around. I was about 15. I think I was 15. And in the English curriculum, I was at an American school, and I had this wonderful teacher called Mrs. Miller, and she sort of introduced us to poetry, mm-hmm. and we got given an assignment, and I hadn't done it, very usual with me and a homework, and it was my mom on the way to school, sort of, for some reason she found out, she never usually asked about homework, but this time she did, and she was like, come on, you've got to do this, just do something so you can hand in, and I remember writing a poem in the car about the walk from the front door of our house to the car. And it happened to be autumn, and which is one of my favorite seasons, and there was this carpet of red leaves, and I wrote this sort of very short poem about that little walk, handed it in, went to school the next day, and it was the first time, I'm not going to say I was suddenly given an A+. I think I got like a B-. It wasn't like I was suddenly a genius in poetry, but it was a B. It was something that wasn't a D or an F, or it was pretty amazing. I mean, I dined on it at home. I think my dad almost cried when he saw it. We had never sort of seen that. And it was the first time I'd kind of been given a pat on the back for something that wasn't sports, really. Until that age, sports was kind of the only place that I was good at. Funnily enough, my mom almost immediately told me this story about a friend of hers. She had back in the 60s. My mom in the 60s was very much surrounded by like an amazing scene. You know, she would be at parties and there was an American kid playing guitar in the corner, as she puts it, and it ended up being James Taylor. So oh. she kind of had a lot of these sort of amazing stories of the London, the swinging 60s and all that. And it was a friend of hers whose name I can't remember now, but she said he did the same thing, and she told him, why don't you put it to music? And he became quite a successful songwriter. So she said to me, why don't you try putting it to music, put this poem to music? And all my friends were starting to play guitar and stuff like that, and I kind of just, with two chords, put this poem to a song. And I remember sitting in the kitchen and playing it to my mom, and the thing that really struck me was, not only was I like sort of proud of this thing that I had created out of thin air, but it was what it did to her. She needed that. It was a moment in our lives where things weren't really going great, and it was basically me and my mom living at home alone pretty much, and she sort of really responded to this. It was almost like the same effect of a hug or of a gesture of affection, even though the song had nothing to do with her. I hadn't written a song about her or for her. It was a song about, you know, leaves on the floor on the way to the car. Yeah. But it really hit her, and I thought, this is amazing. I can sort of express myself, feel proud of my expressions rather than embarrassed or whatever, and it actually affects somebody. It connects with somebody. And that was kind of where I got my first taste of not music, but the power that music has to connect people, which is what essentially I'm attracted to about music.
Yeah, that's where you found your imagination.
Yeah, it's where I allowed my imagination to somewhat attempt to connect with others.
Yeah.
Because up until then, my imagination had just been for me. I never felt that it had a value to be shared, or never sort of felt like it had a, I don't want to say altruistic value, because it's not like I sort of did it out of charity. I benefited from that connection as much as the person receiving it. And I still do. I mean, I benefit from singing a song to a crowd as much as the crowd receiving it. If they like it or if they hate it. If they don't like it, I feel that. I feel that just as much as I feel that if they do like it. So it's a two-way street there.
Yeah, I remember that from myself when I was a kid. I found it very difficult to communicate, and I found that writing poems and lyrics was a way of being in a safe place, a place where I could communicate with myself, and it just felt like, wow, this is going to be my future.
I definitely feel like there's a safe space to be honest, and I know that sounds weird, but it's really hard to be honest. I mean, we all crave to be honest. We all try to be honest. We all want to be honest. We all maybe convince ourselves that we are being honest. But most of the time, we're kind of covering up even honesty with BS, because we're afraid of what somebody might truly feel when they know how we truly are thinking. I don't know if that makes sense. I think there's always a protection to most people when they are communicating. At least to me, even when I'm trying to be honest, there's an element of protection I'll put in front of it, just in case what I'm trying to, you know, share isn't received the right way. I have space to maneuver. But when you're sat at a piano or with a guitar, you're kind of released from those chains of opinion until somebody really hears it, but while you're making it. So it allows this flow of conscious to really say stuff. Sometimes I feel songs are quite scary because they can feel like a premonition because of that. You can sometimes say things or sing about things that are happening in your life that you haven't really admitted to yourself yet. Or you can see if a relationship is falling apart. I mean, I've written about breakups before the breakup has happened. You know what I mean? Put it
so
that way.
So have I.
And it's always quite scary when you do write a certain song. You're like, oh, crap. Maybe there's something here I'm not really dealing with. And I'm afraid to sometimes play people songs that I've written because I'm like, ooh.
Is it like a form of therapy for you?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I mean, I think this is why probably for the first time in my life, I've been considering going to therapy because I haven't had my outlet for the last 2.5 years. Yes, I've been writing. Yes, I've been making music. And I always thought that was essentially my main outlet, but I haven't had that standing in front of a room of people and shouting and feeling it connect. I haven't had that, which is essentially why one goes to therapy, you know? It's kind of like a bouncing board off of it. It's not just you acknowledging what the situation is. It's kind of being able to share it with somebody is really important. It's the same reason you confess to a priest and not to a wall. You know what I mean? It's that illusion of somebody else connecting with you that makes you feel comforted by it. And I haven't had that. And I've definitely felt the weight of that for sure.
So was lockdown a bit of a lonely time?
No, I mean, quite the opposite. That's a very good question, because maybe that has made me acknowledge that just because you're in a room full of people doesn't mean you're not lonely, which I guess is the beautiful distraction of being a traveling musician, is you never have to admit to your loneliness because you're always surrounded by people. But I think it's been a very catastrophic in so many ways two years for so many, for everybody, you know, on so many different elements. But it's magnified the personal. I've had a real opportunity in many respects too, because big things have happened. We had our third child, my father passed away. It was very big things happened that, don't get me wrong, would have been super like effective to my life even if COVID never happened. But being sort of still in one place while these things have happened, you really can't escape it. You have to take the wave. You can't run from it. You're standing in the same place. You're stuck in that place. So the wave just keeps hitting you and you're like, woof. I'd like to turn my back on this sometimes, but you can't because of the circumstances. And now that we're sort of getting back to moving again, I realize how important that is for me to cope with these things.
Yeah, absolutely. If you go back to your teenage years again, was there anything that sort of struck you about your environment that became part of your songwriting?
Yeah, very much so. I went to an American school. I was put into an American school when I was about 13 or 12 probably, and that had a huge impact on me. I had gone from a very sort of privileged English school from the ages of sort of 3 to 7 in Fulham, which is where I was born. Then I moved to Switzerland and I went to a sort of state school. I mean, in Europe, most schools are state schools and they're good schools. It's a very different form of education. Private is very scarce. It's a very sort of, you don't have that many sort of options. I went to an Italian state school, you know, which was very different from the English education I had. It was priests. It was like a Salesiani. So I don't know how you say that in English. But anyway, it was priests and it was quite sort of narrow-minded in all that respect. And then I went to this American school, which was incredibly creative, liberal, artistic. If you were rubbish at maths and science, they wouldn't tell you were stupid. They would almost over indulge you in art and creativity and try to find. It was really American. It was try to motivate you in what you were good at rather than shoot you down for what you couldn't do. At least American in the 90s. America might have changed a bit now, but
really.
It was that very gung-ho, positive, you know, you can do it, be all that you can be kind of vibe. And I was really pushed to creativity. They very quickly saw. So, and all of my friends were American, even though I was growing up in this Italian part of Switzerland. All my friends were American. So I grew up in this sudden, like, teenage American lifestyle where the music that entered into my world completely changed my life. Because up until then, music to me had been, you know, some sort of Now compilation that my mom would give me at Christmas. And it was just party.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was just whatever was there. I didn't really think about it. Although my parents always listened to great music, up until the age of 13, 14, I didn't really consider it. And then I went to an American school and all my friends were listening to The Grateful Dead, Crosby, Stills and Nash, The Doors, James Taylor, Kris Kristofferson, Joni Mitchell, Joan Baez, Bob Dylan. It was that time as well in the 90s where 60s music came back again and various films were coming out that were sort of all about that time period. I mean, the Forrest Gump soundtrack changed my life. I know that's a bit random.
I just remember
those. I was about 13 or 14 when that film came out. Because of that movie, I got obsessed with that. My next birthday, I got given Woodstock and The Last Waltz. And those two DVDs were like my, I think they were videos even at the time. They were my sort of education. So that had a huge impact on me suddenly going from not caring about music to wanting to be Stephen Stills, like to wanting to be Jackson Brown, to wanting to move to Laurel Canyon. You know, I bought a leather jacket, a turtleneck. I think I even put glasses on at one point just to look more like sort of John Lennon. I went the whole shebang.
That's incredible. I mean, when I was growing up, all that music I kind of shuffled away from, but I came back to at a later time. You know, it's like James Taylor for me. I saw him play 15, 20 years ago, and suddenly the penny dropped. The beauty of his writing.
Well, I had that with Springsteen. I never got Springsteen when I was younger. Like, I always found it a little bit...
No, I
found
didn't.
It hectic, to be honest. I was really into the Simon & Garfunkel was my... That was my sort of a moment of enlightenment. Hearing Kathy's song and The Only Living Boy in New York. Listening to those 3.5 minutes and feeling like I had read a novel or seen a movie. That blew my mind. And Springsteen was just quite hectic. That I never really listened to what he was saying, to be quite honest. And it was only in my late 20s. I don't even know why. I was in L.A. making my second album in Santa Monica at Jackson Browne Studio. He wasn't there, unfortunately. I did get to meet him briefly in the parking lot, but he wasn't there. But I was working with this other guy who had sorted this all out, and he was obsessed with Springsteen, and he just kept playing me Springsteen. And one night, you know, was sitting there in the late early hours of the morning drinking a beer, something came on. I think it was Thunder Road. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh, wow, I didn't realize this guy was this. I kind of always just thought he was yelling and I didn't really listen. And the penny dropped, like you said.
Did you see his one-man show at all?
I saw bits of it. And if I'm totally honest, I preferred the storytelling than when he was actually sort of singing. I kind of loved his story, his telling.
Yeah,
I loved that.
Me too.
I loved that. I thought that was absolutely brilliant.
It was an expensive seat, if I remember.
I watched it on TV.
it was on TV.
I think it was either Sky Arts or somewhere showed it for a bit. It was like a special, but I watched it on TV. But James Taylor has a great one-man show. That's a brilliant one.
Yeah, that is incredible. Like that. Yeah. What was it like getting your first record deal? It's always a buzz, isn't it?
Well, maybe not in my case.
Oh,
because
no.
I didn't sign to a major till my last album, till my sixth album.
Oh.
So before that, it was only indies. I mean, I had a moment with BMG in the middle, which they call themselves an independent, but I think that's a little bit unfair compared to other independent. They don't have the budget of an independent, put it that way. They've got serious budgets behind them. But when I say independence, I mean real independence, like people that just had a bit of cash and wanted to do something. You know, I didn't go with the cool labels and all that. It was really like sort of makeshift independent record labels. So my first label was kind of a survival situation. It was with my management at the time, and nobody was picking us up. We had been offered deals, various deals in the States, funnily enough, but they were all pretty rubbish deals. And yeah, I mean, looking back, maybe we should have taken them. I always regret maybe turning away. There was a great deal from Geffen Records at the time when I was like sort of 21, and I really wanted to move to LA. I felt very at home in Los Angeles. And so, yeah, maybe looking back, that would have been a good one. But my first record label was basically my management and I putting a label together because we weren't being offered a deal. So even though I was...
And did it work?
No. Well, it did. I mean, it did. It got the ball rolling, for sure. It started my career.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it didn't end on the best terms. I had very different ideas, creatively, professionally, and also personally. It all got very blurred. And, I mean, I won't go into too much detail for legal reasons, but it really didn't work out. It was every cliche you've ever sort of read about your first management and record deal kind of thing, and it all fell apart. But that really educated me into, like, choosing the right people to work with rather than the big names or, you know, I want to do this for life. I didn't want to do this like a sort of casino, let's roll the dice and try to win on the first night. I want to stay here at the table for the rest of my life. So let's just play it cool and stay in the game rather than gambling it all.
Yeah, sounds very familiar, that record deal management thing. I signed a contract when I was 18 years old, and consequently, most of the songs I've written I don't own for the rest of my life.
I mean, really?
And lost 50% of it. But, you know, without doing that, I wouldn't be sitting in this
shed. Exactly. That's exactly how I feel. I've kind of come at peace with it. There have been situations later. The past has crept up on me in situations like you're talking about regarding to ownership and things like that. And it surprised me at how angry it made me. And probably how angry it had made me at the time, but I kind of buried it. And I think a lot of my early drugs and alcohol and very bad behavior had a lot to do with that. Because at the time where that happened, I really went off the rails. And it was
You were spinning.
Yeah, it spun me out. And I was only like 24. And, you know, I had a baby on the way. And, you know, it really throws you when people who you've really, really, like, trusted and
trust, and
you want to do, especially at that young, naive stage where you're really not in it to screw anybody over. You know, you don't have that head on your shoulders at that age. I mean, some people do have it on their head at that age, but I didn't. I was really just like, you know, it was all about the song and the music. I went into it completely naively, to say the least. You feel very humiliated. I felt very stupid. I blamed myself for a long time, and I still do, and I'd still rather blame myself than blame anybody else, because I sort of probably should have felt that I had that responsibility at the time, which I didn't. So now I really think about the people I invite to sit at the table with us.
What's great, of course, is you're in a good position now. You've got a good record label and you've recorded with Nile Rodgers, and that doesn't get much better than working with that. He's such a cool guy, isn't he?
He's ridiculously cool, because you think he can't be that cool. Like, you know, it's a front when you meet him. Instead, he's actually cooler when you meet him, then, because he's just so genuinely in love with what he does. And he's a real, you know, you have to make a decision early on. What are you in this for? What's the deal here? Are you going to gamble everything for that glory? Or are you just going to do it slow and steady? And I've always really wanted to do it slow and steady. I mean, I wouldn't mind of having a bit more glory, but I do like to just make sure that I kind of know where it's coming from, successes and failures. I know too many people that have had that, like, bang moment, and they have no idea why, and then it kind of bites them in the backside a couple of years later. But Nile is exactly that sort of personification of how to do the long game, how to win at the long game, and that's work as much as you can, work. I always say this to musicians that I meet now. They're like, what's the trick? What is your advice? I'm like, go to work. Go play. Like, you want to be a musician? Go play. Play the crappiest places. Do it. Do it, do it, do it. Do as much as it'll, you know, keep playing. Don't sit and wait. Do not, like, allow that to happen, because nobody's going to come and knock in. And, you know, work with people you didn't think you would work with. Like, expand it, you know. I wouldn't say yes to everything, but...
Take a risk, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Take a few risks. Mm. And you'll learn about yourself. You know, you'll learn, okay, I really don't want to do that. And it's important to figure that out as quickly as possible. And you might also realize, oh, wow, that was actually really cool. I didn't know I loved doing that. And Nile is the perfect example of that. Somebody who's continuously challenging himself and challenging others around him by doing that. And it creates an amazing amount of respect. You can't help but respect the man.
So did you bring all the songs to the table prior to making the album, or did Nile sort of pitch in?
No, we kind of brought this song to the table because I can't tell you how many times I've sat in a studio and said, let's put some Nile Rodgers-style guitar here. Let's put some, you know what I mean? Or, you know, give me the guitar and let me try and put some of the, you know, terribly tried to imitate.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was actually in the studio with Mark Ralph, who I was writing the song with. Europiana is the name of the album, and I really wanted to try to capture this European funk disco kind of music that I remember listening to as a kid in Italy in the 80s, and bringing that sort of hot Mediterranean night, like, kind of disco that's just on the edge of, ooh, is this too much? Oh, it's too good. I don't care. It makes me feel good. You know what I mean? Verging on being just cheeky, I guess, is the best way I would put it. And I said, oh, I'd love to put some Nile Rodgers style guitar down here. And I started terribly trying to mimic it. And Mark actually said, oh, it'd be great to get Nile to do this, wouldn't it? And I said, yeah, it would. And he goes, I know him. I actually did some work with him in the past. Should we reach out to him? And we thought, yeah, why not? Only the brave. Let's see. And he got back immediately. And it was great because me and him spoke. And I explained to him the whole concept of the album and the fact that he single-handedly changed European music. And I didn't know if he was aware of this. I found out that he was very aware of this because I told him, I was like, in Italy and France, all these artists, they changed because of this sound of disco and funk that was coming from the States, which he was very much, you know, the main driver of. And what I really wanted to capture was European reason for doing that had a very different aspiration than American disco. American disco was counterculture. It was pretty much illegal at the beginning. Do you know what I mean? It was very much in clubs that weren't necessarily accepted at the time. But by the time it got to Europe, it was very glamorous. It was quite sort of bougie, and I really like that. And I wanted to show that the same sound of music, when it travels into a different culture, it can sound the same, but it's aspiring for something different.
Yeah.
And I just said, it'd be amazing to have you on the record as kind of like the godfather of Europiana. And he loved that. He's like, oh, I like the godfather of Europiana. And he was aware of it because I grew up in summers in Liguria, in a place called Portofino and all that. And there's a club there called Covo, and he used to be the musical director there. And funnily enough, my father actually saw him. And he came to Italy in a lot of clubs, La Bussola, which was this very famous club just outside of Rome. And he was the musical director there because all these Italian bands, he said, wanted to learn how to play like Barry White's band. So he was brought in and taught them all this kind of like disco funk from the States. And it changed European music. Suddenly, Serge Gainsbourg, Julio Iglesias, Patti Pravo, Lucio Battisti, they all started sounding like this. And so he has a big reason to do with that. So to get his seal of approval was awesome.
Oh, my God. What a dream.
It was cool.
What a dream. In every episode of I Never Thought It Would Happen, we hear from an artist who's benefited directly from Help Musicians and learn a little about their experiences and the support the charity provides.
My name's Abigail Otway and I'm a musician and actor from Bradford, West Yorkshire, and I've got a duo with my husband. We've also got a professional function band, the Mark and Abby Band, and one of them pays the bills and then the other one threatens to cut the lights out. I was that kid in the playground when I was like 8 or 9 singing I'm a dreamer. I was like, yeah, I could sing, and we'd like pretend to be pop stars with hairbrushes in the playground. I went to uni and I started working in clubs and bars and they were very smoky. I completely lost my voice. For a long time I had nodules from speaking really loudly over really loud music and with the smoke and everything. I'd say that happened when I was about 20 and I just didn't sing. That's the end of my career. And when I was 26, one of my best friends pushed me to go to her auntie's open mic night at a pub in Yeadon, if you've ever heard of Leeds Bradford Airport. And I sang a song to a backing track because I didn't play any instruments. And her auntie wanted to book me. She was like, I want to book you for a gig. I said, oh, I only know like 2 or 3 songs. She said, well, there's a lad over there with a guitar. I'll book you and him and you can share the night and he can do some songs. Maybe you could do some together. That's how I met Mark. And we were gigging together all the time. And we were best friends probably for about 2 years before we realised, actually. Can't imagine the rest of our lives without each other. And now we're married. And then all sorts has happened since then. So it's never too late. In terms of the high points in our career, I would say playing at Latitude Festival, doing mini tours in the US. We've performed in Tahiti. I played on the Terrace of Houses of Parliament. These are all good memories to me. We were cuddling in bed and Mark found... I say we're cuddling in bed and he found a lump on my boob. It sounds like we were up to stuff, which is fine because we're married, but... And he had his hand on my rib and he felt like a really hard lump and he went, what's that? I was up, I was feeling it. I was like, this feels bad. So I booked an appointment with a doctor who didn't really take me seriously. He was like, come back in 2 weeks if it's not gone. And my mum was like, you need to go and get a second opinion. So I went and got a second opinion and then all of a sudden the room was full of people and they were like, right, we're biopsying now. NHS was fantastic, by the way. They got me in, whipped the lump out within like 2 weeks of finding it. And it was just as the world was starting to realise about COVID-19. 10th of March, my operation, 2020. As soon as I got the news, first of all I could think about was, what are we going to do for a living? Me and my husband, we work together, we're a duo, we earn all of our money together. And that was my biggest fear, and I didn't know where to turn. I'd say that Help Musicians were amazing. Help Musicians, financial help, really just took off that extra layer of worry. You know, we weren't worrying about what we were going to eat on top of everything else. Also, just having somebody check in with me, asking me how I am on emails, kind of stopped me from feeling sorry for myself some of the days, because I had to perk myself up and be like, do you know what, actually? Yeah, I'm all right, thanks for asking. How are you guys? Because also, everybody else's world then got turned upside down. But partway through my radiotherapy treatment, my dad, he started getting really ill. And we dropped him off down at the hospital to go in for some tests and they just kept him in. And this is probably the worst thing that ever happened to me and my mum. Well, it's the worst thing that ever happened to me dad as well. He wasn't allowed to see any of us. And he got a terminal cancer diagnosis. Basically, he received all that bad news, like I did a couple of weeks previous, but he was there to comfort me and my husband was there, my mum. He had to take that news on his own. Eventually, they let us in. They said, right, you're allowed in now because he's end of life. By the time we got to see him, he couldn't speak. He couldn't even open his eyes. The last thing he said to me was, why can't I go home? So we managed to get an ambulance, get him home. He had a full night there with me and my mum at his side. And in the morning, after he'd had a little bit of time with us, that's when he decided to drift off. Yeah, he died. So yeah, it were a bad time for us. I know a lot of people were going through that, but I've got a good family around me. and I've got music, so that got me through. We're super busy with the weddings, and we've been booked for another cruise in Tahiti, so we've got that to look forward to. But our big baby at the moment that we're really passionate about is Mookie and the Bab. It got me through lockdown, to be honest. Writing some of these songs are very close and personal to us. We're going to be releasing music this summer, and that is what we're really looking forward to. But I feel like there's light at the end of the tunnel.
You can discover how to support Help Musicians, and you can find them on all social media platforms, or you can go to their website at helpmusicians.org. What is your songwriting process? Are you disciplined?
No. it's the plain
You're chaotic.
No, I'm not chaotic. Like everything in life, I think the greatest thing to do is to remove expectation. I think that's probably the greatest lesson my parents taught me, is they never put the weight of their expectations on myself or my sister, for that matter. We could literally show up at dinner one night and say, I think I want to be an astronaut. And they'd be like, awesome. And leave it at that. Like they would just leave it at that. You know, there was never don't be ridiculous. So, you know, it was always like, okay, cool. And that was always it. We never felt the burden of, you know, sometimes you can get the weight of other people's expectations. And they never did that. And I have that with songwriting. You know, when it happens, I am literally blown away. Every time I write a song, for that split second I finished it, just after I finished it, I am 100% convinced that is the greatest song that has ever been written, purely because I can't believe that it's happened. Then within a matter of minutes, I start analyzing it, criticizing it, and changing it. But that experience is something that I like to let it just do what it does. I think it was Ray Charles who said that. I don't say I have to write a song today, but if I feel like writing a song, I make sure that whatever else is going on, I'm not going to let it interfere. I want to write a song today. So I remove the expectation, but I always respect the moment where I feel like I need to do it.
And do you have a co-writing buddy that you work with?
Yeah, I have a few, and they're all a kind of close network. I mean, two or three of them are in my band, so that's been really good. But that was kind of something I tried to bring out of them, because I wanted them to be more personally involved also in the whole thing. Because we are in a band. Technically, we're not a band.
Yeah.
So sometimes I can see from their feeling that it looks like sometimes the pendulum swings a lot sort of towards me. So I just wanted to make them realize, before you make up in your head what this is, jump on board and see the reality. I wanted them to sort of realize, you know, I'm not walking away with a bag full of roses here. Like, you know, and I wanted them to be more invested into what they're pushing. I don't want them to be just doing it for a paycheck, which I know they're not. But after a year of touring an album, if you don't really have anything attached to it, your mood changes. You want to go home.
Yeah,
whereas if, you know, there's a song on the album that is yours, you'll stick around. And I like that. It was my way of keeping these very talented musicians with me. But it's about a network of about six or seven guys that whenever I'm starting to write an album, I call them all up and we all get together. And that's John Green is a phenomenal writer. Mm-hmm. Sam Dixon, who used to be Adele's musical director, is one of the most amazing bass players and songwriters. And it's great writing with a bass player, because, you know, you immediately approach a song from groove, which I think is fantastic. It's really fun for me to do that.
Yeah,
Shannon Harris, my musical director, who I've written a lot of songs on the last album. Pedro Vito, my guitarist, I've written a lot of songs with. So yeah, it's kind of always that group of guys, to be honest.
That sounds good. And do you get together very often with the team?
I mean, I get together very often with them for the fact that half of them, like I said, are with my band, in the band. So we travel a lot, we're together a lot. But for writing, I'm kind of always writing. But when it comes to like, okay, I want to get an album together, I always want to see if I can better the songs that I've written alone. And that's when I get the guys in. When I'm like, listen, I think I've got 15 songs that I could make an album with. This is where the album's about, and that's where the theme of the album will come up. Because I do like concept to albums. I'm still very much an album kind of person. I haven't really jumped on the whole singles thing. I really like a body of work. It makes me feel a lot more, I don't know, it excites me more. I like to think of it as a film or a book, and the songs are kind of characters within it.
Sounds like it's leaning towards musical theatre.
Yeah, almost. Cabaret, almost.
Cabaret?
Yeah, almost that sort of Yeah, it is almost a musical theatre. Actually, somebody asked me the other day, would you ever write a musical? And I would absolutely love to write a musical.
You should. You'd be amazing.
I would love to do that. I actually think my last album, Singing to Strangers, would have been a great musical.
What an amazing title as well.
Exactly. I thought that's a great name for a musical, isn't it? Singing to Strangers.
I could see it on the totally. On the hoarding, Shaftesbury Avenue.
Exactly. Me too.
Come on, you just got to find a guy to write the script.
I know.
What was the first live band that you went to see?
Bob Dylan, believe it or not. And that's,
no, I come know. On.
Bob Dylan in Zurich.
Terrible.
I know, in Zurich. It was terrible, but it was fantastic. It was terrible because it was half empty. It was at the hockey stadium in Zurich. Mm-hmm. And it was my American girlfriend at the time, my high school sweetheart, called Ashley Taylor. I mean, you can't get more American sweetheart than that. And I think it was my 16th birthday, and she got tickets to go see Bob. And we took the train from Lugano, where we lived, to Zurich, like 2.5 hours, got to the stadium. Mm-hmm. And this was a time where, like, let's just say cannabis was legal in Switzerland. So the whole country sort of created a generation of, like, hippies overnight. My school was hilarious. My American school, when I got there, it was, like, very sporty school. And then because of this weird legislation, which only lasted a few years, suddenly everybody became poets, photographers, and, like, artists. It was incredible. It was a real social experiment. Anyway, we went to go see Bob, and it was half empty. So you could walk to the back of the stadium, grab a beer, and, like, walk to the stage and sort of lean on the front. And that's how empty it was. This was, I would say, 98, 99, maybe. He wasn't trendy at all at the time.
Did he engage you?
No, not really. I mean, he didn't acknowledge the crowd at all. I've seen him a few times, and this was definitely the best time I ever saw him. You could actually recognize the songs he was singing. Whereas I've seen him later on. I saw him in LA at the Staples Center, and it was cool, but I didn't really recognize any songs until maybe the last line. I'd be like, oh, I think that was that. But it was amazing. I remember the thing that really hit me was, when I saw him walk out on stage, I was kind of like, that's it? That's just a guy. And, you know, Bob Dylan and I had pictures on my wall. I'd watched so many documentaries about him. I was pretty, you know, not obsessed, but I loved Bob Dylan. I loved that whole scene. And when I just saw this little man walk out and sit at the piano, and then I just thought, I want to do that. That looks like a pretty cool
job.
I guess anybody can do it. You don't have to be doing backflips or, like, dancing. You know, you can be a legend just by writing good tunes. And, I think that was kind of the real trigger where I was like, that's cool. It looked very doable in a weird way, if that makes any sense.
Oh, absolutely. I had the same experience, but when I went to see David Bowie, and he was very young, I was very young, and I was like, wow, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
But I could never get as thin as him, so it didn't kind of didn't really work for me.
Nobody cared. But, that was a Bowie trick, for sure.
I know, it was. What do you make of people like Bob Dylan and Nile Rodgers selling their catalogues?
Good for them.
Good for them.
Good for them. I mean, right on. Show me the money and take it to the bank. I don't know. I mean, Merck Mercurius, who started all this, this is a real big thing.
Yeah.
And I think he knows what he's doing. And hats off, you know. I think writers have been given the blunt end of the stick. What's the expression?
Yeah.
The short end of the stick for a long time, especially with all this new technology coming in. I think it's time for writers to be really reevaluated. I mean, I was reading somewhere the other day, like, various stats of, like, the music industry was a $12 billion industry last year or something, and 17% went to the writers. I don't think that's right. I think this is a cool way to do it. The only thing about all this is that it makes it really difficult, again, for new artists. Just when this technology was starting to sort of open the doors for new artists, this catalog fund sort of system of floating all this stuff, it kind of really brings so much value again to the past, which is just going to be a bit of a struggle. But I think that's just a sort of turning point.
Yeah. The good thing about it, from what I see anyway, is it becomes song management rather than song publishing.
Totally.
So they actually manage your songs rather than just put your song on a list with everybody else's and no one ever does anything.
Absolutely. And that's kind of what publishing should be.
Yeah.
But it never really is. Although, you know, I've had good experiences and I've had bad experiences. And
have you had covers?
Has anybody covered one of mine?
Yeah.
No. And I say no like that because I'm really disappointed, because I always I always think I can write a hit better than I can sing a hit. I always feel like, oh man, if so-and-so sung this would be massive. So I've always felt that I can definitely write a hit better than I can sing a hit. Oh no, but I have written with some great artists. So they've never covered one of my songs, but I've written with Kylie Minogue. I've written with James Blunt. Yeah, that's been amazing.
How was the Kylie day?
Kylie was amazing. Kylie was amazing because we wrote a song called Music's Too Sad, and it's a very sort of somber ballad. And a lot of people were like, really? You had a chance to write with Kylie and that's what you wrote? And I was like, yeah, because I think Kylie is kind of, she's this magnificent sort of Edith Piaf character to me, where she's this very strong woman that has survived in a very vicious industry.
Yeah.
And she's really done it with tremendous class and style and talent and hard work, really, really hard work. But at the same time, you know, has seen some stuff. She's really been through it, you know. She hasn't been sheltered from the bad sides of what can happen if you dedicate your life to this game. And I really wanted to try and write a song with her that showed that side of her. I thought that was such a beautiful, romantic side of her life and her personality and her legend. And I played it to her, and funnily enough, I remember the first time I played it to her, she went, "Oh, that's a bit depressing." And I was like, oh, and I remember I was writing it with a friend of mine, Sam Dixon, who I said before, the bass player, and he kind of looked at me like, mate, what have you done? We've got Kylie in the studio, and that's what you choose to play her. And she said, give me the microphone. And we gave her the microphone, and she goes, play it again. And I played the verse and chorus sort of part again, and she just sang it almost immediately back at me. And I remember having my headphones on in the studio and thinking, oh, man, she sounds just like Kylie Minogue. This is amazing. Like, it was that Kylie voice. And you were like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Her execution of it, her conviction. I remember she had a sort of tear in her eye. And I was just flabbergasted by this. I was like, oh, my God, I'm in the presence of the real deal. And then she sang this whole sort of middle eight section. And it was like, boom. And I'm not joking, I think an hour later we had a finished song. And it was just amazing. But it was supposed to be for a film. And then, it was on a film and it was supposed to be just her. And then about a couple months later, her people got in touch and they were like, Kylie would like to put the song on her new album. Is that cool for you? And I was like, yeah, that's amazing. She'd like to put it there as a duet. And I was like, oh, man, I remember I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. I mean, we performed it on, like, the Jonathan Ross show together. We did it in the London Palladium together with the Michael McIntosh. I mean, it was nuts. She came to play at La Fenice, which is the most beautiful opera house in Venice, where I was finishing this acoustic tour, and I invited her to come as a guest. And she said yes. And actually, that's where we filmed the music video for the song. If you look at the music video for this song, it was filmed a couple of hours before the show in the most beautiful theater in Italy. So I can safely say that whole experience with Kylie was the best, the as good as it gets, let's put it that way.
What are your plans coming up in this strange time?
Well, I'm starting rehearsals in the next couple of days, and we're hitting the road. We're going to do only two European shows, Zurich and Amsterdam, because everything else is a bit too touch and go right now. We've had to move it because European rules are still quite sensitive. They're too delicate for us to sort of invest the time and money that we need to go out there. So we're waiting. But yeah, then we're going to do a sort of 16, 17 day UK tour,
amazing,
which is going to be wild. It's so weird because, you know, we played Wembley Arena like 3 months before COVID hit. And so we were sort of at this, like, the peak of our careers. You know, it was like this kind of Hollywood movie ending for us. You know, we had a number one album. We played Wembley Arena after 15 years of real, you know, struggle, to say the least. And suddenly it was like, we've done it. Pandemic. It was like, oh, man, what a buzzkill that was. But we kept it sane, and now we're looking forward to getting back out and, you know, getting the ball rolling.
Who do you lean on when things are down?
Oof, that's a great question. I mean, I used to lean a lot on my dad, on my father. But my wife is incredible, and especially after the last year. I mean, we were solid in many respects and mad in many others. But we've definitely solidified the solidarity between us, if that makes any sense. I mean, it was a real make or break, I think, for a lot of families and couples. And over the last 2 years. You really, you know, you were forced to live with the person you chose to live with. And not many people actually do that before a pandemic. You know, you can be married to somebody for many years and not really have any idea who they are.
I know.
This didn't really allow that to happen. You got to know people. And we were lucky. We've sort of, it could have gone either way, but we've completely fell in love all over again. Because we went back to being who we were when we met. You know, our outside identities were left at the door. And suddenly it was just two kids living at home again. And that's what we used to be. So it was really good in that respect. So I can safely say, not always, but in the last 3 years, I've been leaning on my wife for sure, big time.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I found the first lockdown scary. And then the second one, I thought, yeah, this is great. I don't want to go anywhere.
I don't want this to kind of end. I mean, it was like, it was,
I don't want to go back on the road. You know. And then on the third time, it was like, okay, I want to go back on the road.
That's how I feel now. So the first one, we had like a sort of second honeymoon. It was spring. It was beautiful weather. I had been away a lot for work. Mm. I mean, I couldn't have asked for a better time for the world to just stop. I know that sounds very selfish. And I say that with a pinch of salt, to say the least. But I was very much like, it was a real, for me, a luxury to be at home with my kids and to not feel like I should have been doing something else or like I was letting somebody else down or that I should be working. You know, it was just, it wasn't my choice. It was just a thing. It was quite nice to, being someone who's always wants to be in control, it was quite liberating to not be in control for the first time. But then slowly, I've started to get a bit panicky of like, okay, I need to go back to work. I really need to go back to work. And now I can't wait, to be honest. I'm really excited about going on tour.
Is there something about it that's going to be different apart from the freedom?
Freedom. I don't know about the freedom. I used to think that going on the road was freedom. Now, I mean, I would say it's far from freedom. It's probably the only place in my life where I have to have responsibilities when I go touring. I have to be disciplined, you know.
That's true.
I have to really be disciplined. I always say if I was a drummer, I would be dead by now. The only thing that's kept me alive is the fact that I have to worry about my voice.
Of course.
Yeah, otherwise, I think, you know, it would have hit the fan very early on. Mm. So there's that. And that's the one thing I'm not looking forward to. It's very stressful. It's quite angst-driven, the whole worrying about just staying healthy when you're on tour.
Yeah.
Just enjoying it.
It's going to be amazing for you. The audiences are just going to catch you whenever you're there. It's going to be a very emotional time.
I feel that because we did like a little record store tour where I actually finally enough ended up getting COVID. After avoiding it for 3 years, I got COVID, the first sort of show we did. And I had to cancel one of them, unfortunately, because I was loving them. They were just brilliant. And it was only like sort of a couple hundred people in these lovely little sort of, we did them in venues up in Leeds, down in Southampton. The crowd were incredible. I mean, we were almost chatting with the crowd more than singing to them. Everybody was really like sort of so friendly. And you could just see in people's faces how much we've all missed that dopamine of live music, of connecting right then and there.
Yeah, that's because that's who we are, I guess.
Absolutely. 100%. But I needed reminding, that's for sure.
Oh. Well, Jack, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're such a lovely guy.
Thank you.
I wish you well on your European tour, and I hope to meet you one of these fine days.
I hope so too, man. Face to face, as they say.
Yeah.
Cheers, man. Thank you so much.
God bless you.
You
too. Cheers. What a charming man that Jack is. He's got such a great attitude and a fantastic outlook on the music business. I can only wish him well. Like me, he discovered life-changing creativity through the outlet of attaching words to tunes bashed out on many acoustic guitars. But unlike me, he's worked with Kylie Minogue. Such a lucky fellow. To find out more about the wonderful work Help Musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information. And please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.